should depreciate the value and necessity of his own revelation. In the idiom of the Quran, the belief of God is inseparable from that of Muhammad. The good works are those which he has enjoined, and the two qualifications imply the profession of Islam, to which all nations and all sects are equally invited. Their spiritual blindness, though excused by ignorance and crowned with virtue, will be scourged with everlasting torments, and the tears which Muhammad shed over the tomb of his mother, for whom he was forbidden to pray, display a striking contrast of humanity and enthusiasm. The doom of the infidels is common. The measure of their guilt and punishment is determined by the degree of evidence which they have rejected, by the magnitude of the errors which they have entertained. The eternal mansions of the Christians, the Jews, the Sabians, the Magians, and idolaters are sunk below each other in the abyss, and the lowest hell is reserved for the faithless hypocrites who have assumed the mask of religion. After the greater part of mankind has been condemned for their opinions, the true believers only will be judged by their actions. The good and evil of each Muslim will be accurately weighed in a real or allegorical balance, and a singular mode of compensation will be allowed for the payment of injuries. The aggressor will refund an equivalent of his own good actions for the benefit of the person whom he has wronged, and if he should be destitute of any moral property, the weight of his sins will be loaded with an adequate share of the demerits of the sufferer. According as the shares of guilt or virtue shall preponderate, the sentence will be pronounced, and all, without distinction, will pass over the sharp and perilous bridge of the abyss. But the innocent, treading in the footsteps of Muhammad, will gloriously enter the gates of paradise, while the guilty will fall into the first and mildest of the seven hells. The term of expiation will vary from 900 to 7,000 years, but the Prophet has judiciously promised that all his disciples, whatever may be their sins, shall be saved by their own faith and his intercession from eternal damnation. It is not surprising that superstition should act most powerfully on the fears of her votaries, since the human fancy can paint with more energy the misery than the bliss of a future life. With the two simple elements of darkness and fire, we create a sensation of pain which may be aggravated to an infinite degree by the idea of endless duration. But the same idea operates with an opposite effect on the continuity of pleasure. And too much of our present enjoyments is obtained from the relief or the comparison of evil. It is naturally enough that an Arabian prophet should dwell with rapture on the groves, the fountains, and the rivers of paradise. But instead of inspiring the blessed inhabitants with a liberal taste for harmony and science, conversation and friendship, he idly celebrates the pearls and diamonds, the robes of silk, palaces of marble, dishes of gold, rich wines, artificial dainties, numerous attendants, and the whole train of sensual and costly luxury which becomes insipid to the owner, even in the short period of this mortal life. 72 houris, or black-eyed girls of resplendent beauty, blooming youth, virgin purity and exquisite sensibility will be created for the use of the meanest believer. A moment of pleasure will be prolonged to 1,000 years, and his faculties will be increased 100-fold to render him worthy of his felicity. Notwithstanding a vulgar prejudice, the gates of heaven will be open to both sexes. But Muhammad has not specified the male companions of the female elect, lest he should either alarm the jealousy of their former husbands, or disturb their felicity by the suspicion of an everlasting marriage. This image of a carnal paradise has provoked the indignation, perhaps the envy, of the monks. They declaim against the impure religion of Muhammad, and his modest apologists are driven to the poor excuse of figures and allegories. But the sounder and more consistent party adhere without shame to the literal interpretation of the Quran. Useless would be the resurrection of the body unless it were restored to the possession and exercise of its worthiest faculties, and the union of sensual and intellectual enjoyment is requisite to complete the happiness of the double animal, the perfect man. Yet the joys of the Mohammedan paradise will not be confined to the indulgence of luxury and appetite, and the Prophet has expressly declared that all meaner happiness will be forgotten and despised by the saints and martyrs who shall be admitted to the beatitude of the divine vision. The first and most arduous conquests of Muhammad were those of his wife, his servant, his pupil, and his friend, since he presented himself as a prophet to those who were most conversant with his infirmities as a man. Yet Khadija believed the words and cherished the glory of her husband. The obsequious and affectionate Zayd was tempted by the prospect of freedom. The illustrious Ali, the son of Abu Talib, embraced the sentiments of his cousin with the spirit of a youthful hero. And the wealth, the moderation, the veracity of Abu Bakr confirmed the religion of the Prophet whom he was destined to succeed. By his persuasion, 10 of the most respectable citizens of Mecca were introduced to the private lessons of Islam. They yielded to the voice of reason and enthusiasm. They repeated the fundamental creed, "There is but one God, and Muhammad is the apostle of God." And their faith, even in this life, was rewarded with riches and honors, with the command of armies and the government of kingdoms. 3 years was silently employed in the conversion of 14 proselytes, the first fruits of his mission. But in the 4th year he assumed the prophetic office, and resolving to impart to his family the light of divine truth, he prepared a banquet, a lamb, as it is said, and a bowl of milk, for the entertainment of 40 guests of the race of Hashem. "Friends and kinsmen," said Muhammad to the assembly, "I offer you, and I alone can offer, the most precious of gifts, the treasures of this world and of the world to come. God has commanded me to call you to his service. Who among you will support my burden? Who among you will be my companion and my vizier?" No answer was returned till the silence of astonishment and doubt and contempt was at length broken by the impatient courage of Ali, a youth in the 14th year of his age. "O Prophet, I am the man. Whosoever rises against thee, I will dash out his teeth, tear out his eyes, break his legs, rip up his belly. O Prophet, I will be thy vizier over them." Muhammad accepted his offer with transport, and Abu Talib was ironically exhorted to respect the superior dignity of his son. In a more serious tone, the father of Ali advised his nephew to relinquish his impracticable design. "Spare your remonstrances," replied the intrepid fanatic to his uncle and benefactor. "If they should place the sun on my right hand and the moon on my left, they should not divert me from my course." He persevered 10 years in the exercise of his mission, and the religion which has overspread the East and the West advanced with a slow and painful progress within the walls of Mecca. Yet Mohammed enjoyed the satisfaction of beholding the increase of his infant congregation of Unitarians, who revered him as a prophet, and to whom he seasonably dispensed the spiritual nourishment of the Quran. The number of proselytes may be esteemed by the absence of 83 men and 18 women who retired to Ethiopia in the 7th year of his mission, and his party was fortified by the timely conversion of his uncle Hamza and of the fierce and inflexible Omar, who signalized in the cause of Islam the same zeal which he had exerted for its destruction. Nor was the charity of Muhammad confined to the tribe of Quraysh or the precincts of Mecca. On solemn festivals, in the days of pilgrimage, he frequented the Kaaba, accosted the strangers of every tribe, and urged both in private converse and public discourse the belief and worship of a sole deity. Conscious of his reason and of his weakness, he asserted the liberty of conscience and disclaimed the use of religious violence. But he called the Arabs to repentance and conjured them to remember the ancient idolaters of Ad and Thamut, whom the divine justice had swept away from the face of the earth. The people of Mecca were hardened in their unbelief by superstition and envy. The elders of the city, the uncles of the prophet, affected to despise the presumption of an orphan, the reformer of his country. The pious orations of Muhammad in the Kaaba were answered by the clamors of Abu Talib. Citizens and pilgrims, listen not to the tempter. Hearken not to his impious novelties. Stand fast in the worship of Al-Lata and Al-Uzzah. Yet the son of Abdallah was ever dear to the aged chief, and he protected the fame and person of his nephew against the assaults of the Qurayshites, who had long been jealous of the preeminence of the family of Hashem. Their malice was colored with the pretense of religion. In the age of Job, the crime of impiety was punished by the Arabian magistrate, and Mohammed was guilty of deserting and denying the national deities. But so loose was the policy of Mecca that the leaders of the Quraysh, instead of accusing a criminal, were compelled to employ the measures of persuasion or violence. They repeatedly addressed Abu Talib in the style of reproach and menace. Thy nephew reviles our religion. He accuses our wise forefathers of ignorance and folly. Silence him quickly, lest he kindle tumult and discord in the city. If he persevere, we shall draw our swords against him and his adherents, and thou wilt be responsible for the blood of thy fellow citizens. The weight and moderation of Abu Talib eluded the violence of religious faction. The most helpless or timid of the disciples retired to Ethiopia, and the prophet withdrew himself to various places of strength in the town and country. As he was still supported by his family, the rest of the tribe of Quraysh engaged themselves to renounce all intercourse with the children of Hashem, neither to buy nor sell, neither to marry nor to give in marriage, but to pursue them with implacable enmity till they should deliver the person of Muhammad to the justice of the gods. The decree was suspended in the Kaaba before the eyes of the nation. The messengers of the Quraysh pursued the Muslim exiles in the heart of Africa. They besieged the prophet and his most faithful followers, intercepted their water, and inflamed their mutual animosity by the retaliation of injuries and insults. A doubtful truce restored the appearances of concord till the death of Abu Talib abandoned Muhammad to the power of his enemies, at the moment when he was deprived of his domestic comforts by the loss of his faithful and generous Khadija. Abu Sufyan, the chief of the branch of Omiyah, succeeded to the principality of the Republic of Mecca. A zealous votary of the idols, a mortal foe of the line of Hashem, he convened an assembly of the Koreshites and their allies to decide the fate of the apostle. His imprisonment might provoke the despair of his enthusiasm, and the exile of an eloquent and popular fanatic would diffuse the mischief through the provinces of Arabia. His death was resolved, and they agreed that a sword from each tribe should be buried in his heart, to divide the guilt of his blood and baffle the vengeance of the Hashemites. An angel or a spy revealed their conspiracy, and flight was the only resource of Muhammad. At the dead of night, accompanied by his friend Abu Bakr, he silently escaped from his house. The assassins watched at the door, but they were deceived by the figure of Ali, who reposed on the bed and was covered with the green vestment of the apostle. The Quraysh respected the piety of the heroic youth, but some verses of Ali, which are still extant, exhibit an interesting picture of his anxiety, his tenderness, and his religious confidence. 3 days Muhammad and his companion were concealed in the cave of Thor, at the distance of a league from Mecca, and in the close of each evening they received from the son and daughter of Abu Bakr a secret supply of intelligence and food. The diligence of the Quraysh explored every haunt in the neighborhood of the city. They arrived at the entrance of the cavern, but the providential deceit of a spider's web and a pigeon's nest is supposed to convince them that the place was solitary and inviolate. "We are only two," said the trembling Abu Bakr. "There is a third," replied the prophet. "It is God himself." No sooner was the pursuit abated than the two fugitives issued from the rock and mounted their camels. On the road to Medina, they were overtaken by the emissaries of the Quraysh. They redeemed themselves with prayers and promises from their hands. In this eventful moment, the lance of an Arab might have changed the history of the world. The flight of the Prophet from Mecca to Medina has fixed the memorable era of the Hijra, which at the end of 12 centuries still discriminates the lunar years of the Mohammedan nations. The religion of the Quran might have perished in its cradle had not Medina embraced with faith and reverence the holy outcasts of Mecca. Medina, or the city known under the name of Yathrib, before it was sanctified by the throne of the Prophet, was divided between the tribes of the Karagitis and the Ausites, whose hereditary feud was rekindled by the slightest provocations. 2 colonies of Jews, who boasted a sacerdotal race, were their humble allies, and, without converting the Arabs, they introduced the taste of science and religion, which distinguished Medina as the city of the book. Some of her noblest citizens, in a pilgrimage to the Kaaba, were converted by the preaching of Muhammad. On their return, they diffused the belief of God and his prophet, and the new alliance was ratified by their deputies in 2 secret and nocturnal interviews on a hill in the suburbs of Mecca. In the first, 10 Karagites and 2 Ausites, united in faith and love, protested in the name of their wives, their children, and their absent brethren that they would forever profess the creed and observe the precepts of the Quran. The second was a political association, the first vital spark of the empire of the Saracens. 73 men and 2 women of Medina held a solemn conference with Muhammad, his kinsman, and his disciples, and pledged themselves to each other by a mutual oath of fidelity. They promised in the name of the city that if he should be banished, they would receive him as a confederate, obey him as a leader, and defend him to the last extremity, like their wives and children. "But if you are recalled by your country," they asked with a flattering anxiety, "will you not abandon your new allies?" "All things," replied Muhammad with a smile, "are now common between us Your blood is as my blood, your ruin as my ruin. We are bound to each other by the ties of honour and interest. I am your friend and the enemy of your foes. But if we are killed in your service, what, exclaimed the deputies of Medina, will be our reward? Paradise, replied the prophet. Stretch forth thy hand. He stretched it forth, and they reiterated the oath of allegiance and fidelity. Their treaty was ratified by the people, who unanimously embraced the profession of Islam. They rejoiced in the exile of the apostle, but they trembled for his safety and impatiently expected his arrival. After a perilous and rapid journey along the seacoast, he halted at Koba, 2 miles from the city, and made his public entry into Medina 16 days after his flight from Mecca. 500 of the citizens advanced to meet him. He was hailed with acclamations of loyalty and devotion. Mohammed was mounted on a she-camel. An umbrella shaded his head, and a turban was unfurled before him to supply the deficiency of a standard. His bravest disciples, who had been scattered by the storm, assembled round his person, and the equal, though various, merit of the Muslims was distinguished by the names of Muhajirins and Ansars, the fugitives of Mecca, and the auxiliaries of Medina. To eradicate the seeds of jealousy, Mohammed judiciously coupled his principal followers with the rights and obligations of brethren. And when Ali found himself without a peer, the prophet tenderly declared that he would be the companion and brother of the noble youth. The expedient was crowned with success. The holy fraternity was respected in peace and war, and the two parties vied with each other in a generous emulation of courage and fidelity. Once only the concord was slightly ruffled by an accidental quarrel. A patriot of Medina arraigned the insolence of the strangers, but the hint of their expulsion was heard with abhorrence, and his own son most eagerly offered to lay at the apostle's feet the head of his father. From his establishment at Medina, Mohammed assumed the exercise of the regal and sacerdotal office, and it was impious to appeal from a judge whose decrees were inspired by the divine wisdom. A small portion of ground, the patrimony of 2 orphans, was acquired by gift or purchase. On that chosen spot he built a house and a mosque, more venerable in their rude simplicity than the palaces and temples of the Assyrian caliphs. His seal of gold or silver was inscribed with the apostolic title. When he prayed and preached in the weekly assembly, he leaned against the trunk of a palm tree, and it was long before he indulged himself in the use of a chair or pulpit of rough timber. After a reign of 6 years, 1,500 Muslims in arms and in the field renewed their oath of allegiance, and their chief repeated the assurance of protection till the death of the last member, or the final dissolution of the party. It was in the same camp that the deputy of Mecca was astonished by the attention of the faithful to the words and looks of the prophet, by the eagerness with which they collected his spittle, a hair that dropped on the ground, the refuse water of his lustrations, as if they participated in some degree of the prophetic virtue. "I have seen," said he, "the Khosroes of Persia and the Caesar of Rome, but never did I behold a king among his subjects like Mohammed among his companions." The devout fervor of enthusiasm acts with more energy and truth than the cold and formal servility of courts. In the state of nature, every man has a right to defend by force of arms his person and his possessions. To repel or even to prevent the violence of his enemies, and to extend his hostilities to a reasonable measure of satisfaction and retaliation. In the free society of the Arabs, the duties of subject and citizen imposed a feeble restraint, and Mohammed, in the exercise of a peaceful and benevolent mission, had been despoiled and banished by the injustice of his countrymen. The choice of an independent people had exalted the fugitive of Mecca to the rank of a sovereign, and he was invested with the just prerogative of forming alliances and of waging offensive or defensive war. The imperfection of human rights was supplied and armed by the plenitude of divine power. The Prophet of Medina assumed in his new revelations a fiercer and more sanguinary tone, which proves that his former moderation was the effect of weakness. The means of persuasion had been tried. The season of forbearance was elapsed, and he was now commanded to propagate his religion by the sword, to destroy the monuments of idolatry, and, without regarding the sanctity of days or months, to pursue the unbelieving nations of the earth. The same bloody precepts, so repeatedly inculcated in the Quran, are ascribed by the author to the Pentateuch and the Gospel. But the mild tenor of the evangelic style may explain an ambiguous text, that Jesus did not bring peace on the earth, but a sword. His patient and humble virtues should not be confounded with the intolerant zeal of princes and bishops, who have disgraced the name of his disciples. In the prosecution of religious war, Mohammed might appeal with more propriety to the example of Moses, of the judges, and the kings of Israel. The military laws of the Hebrews are still more rigid than those of the Arabian legislator. The Lord of hosts marched in person before the Jews. If a city resisted their summons, the males, without distinction, were put to the sword. The seven nations of Canaan were devoted to destruction, and neither repentance nor conversion could shield them from the inevitable doom that no creature within their precincts should be left alive. The fair option of friendship or submission or battle was proposed to the enemies of Mohammed. If they professed the creed of Islam, they were admitted to all the temporal and spiritual benefits of his primitive disciples, and marched under the same banner to extend the religion which they had embraced. The clemency of the prophet was decided by his interest, yet he seldom trampled on a prostrate enemy, and he seems to promise that on the payment of a tribute, the least guilty of his unbelieving subjects might be indulged in their worship, or at least in their imperfect faith. In the first months of his reign, he practiced the lessons of holy warfare and displayed his white banner before the gates of Medina. The martial apostle fought in person at 9 battles or sieges, and 50 enterprises of war were achieved in 10 years by himself or his lieutenants. The Arab continued to unite the professions of a merchant and a robber, and his petty excursions for the defense or the attack of a caravan insensibly prepared his troops for the conquest of Arabia. The distribution of the spoil was regulated by divine law. The whole was faithfully collected in one common mass. A fifth of the gold and silver, the prisoners and cattle, the movables and immovables, was reserved by the prophet for pious and charitable uses. The remainder was shared in adequate portions by the soldiers who had obtained the victory or guarded the camp. The rewards of the slain devolved to their widows and orphans, and the increase of cavalry was encouraged by the allotment of a double share to the horse and to the man. From all sides, the roving Arabs were allured to the standard of religion and plunder. The apostle sanctified the license of embracing the female captives as their wives or concubines, and the enjoyment of wealth and beauty was a feeble type of the joys of paradise prepared for the valiant martyrs of the faith. The sword, says Mohammed, is the key of heaven and of hell, A drop of blood shed in the cause of God, a night spent in arms, is of more avail than 2 months of fasting or prayer. Whosoever falls in battle, his sins are forgiven. At the day of judgment, his wounds shall be resplendent as vermilion and odoriferous as musk, and the loss of his limbs shall be supplied by the wings of angels and cherubim. The intrepid souls of the Arabs were fired with enthusiasm. The picture of the invisible world was strongly painted on their imagination, and the death which they had always despised became an object of hope and desire. The Quran inculcates in the most absolute sense the tenets of fate and predestination, which would extinguish both industry and virtue if the actions of man were governed by his speculative belief. Yet their influence in every age has exalted the courage of the Saracens and Turks. The first companions of Muhammad advanced to battle with a fearless confidence. There is no danger where there is no chance. They were ordained to perish in their beds, or they were safe and invulnerable amidst the darts of the enemy. Perhaps the Quraysh would have been content with the flight of Muhammad, had they not been provoked and alarmed by the vengeance of an enemy who could intercept their Syrian trade as it passed and repassed through the territory of Medina. Abu Sufyan himself, with only 30 or 40 followers, conducted a wealthy caravan of 1,000 camels. The fortune or dexterity of his march escaped the vigilance of Muhammad. But the chief of the Quraysh was informed that the holy robbers were placed in ambush to await his return. He dispatched a messenger to his brethren of Mecca, and they were roused by the fear of losing their merchandise and their provisions, unless they hastened to his relief with the military force of the city. The sacred band of Muhammad was formed of 313 Muslims, of whom 77 were fugitives, and the rest auxiliaries. They mounted by turns a train of 70 camels. The camels of Yathreb were formidable in war, but such was the poverty of his first disciples that only 2 could appear on horseback in the field. In the fertile and famous vale of Bedir, 3 stations from Medina, he was informed by his scouts of the caravan that approached on one side. Of the Quraysh, 100 horse, 850 foot, who advanced on the other. After a short debate, he sacrificed the prospect of wealth to the pursuit of glory and revenge, and a slight entrenchment was formed to cover his troops, and a stream of fresh water that glided through the valley. O God, he exclaimed as the numbers of the Quraysh descended from the hills, O God, if these are destroyed, by whom wilt thou be worshipped on the earth? Courage, my children, close your ranks, discharge your arrows, and the day is your own. At these words he placed himself with Abu Bakr on a throne or pulpit, and instantly demanded the succor of Gabriel and 3,000 angels. His eye was fixed on the field of battle. The Muslims fainted and were pressed. In that decisive moment, the prophet started from his throne, mounted his horse, and cast a handful of sand into the air. Let their faces be covered with confusion. Both armies heard the thunder of his voice. Their fancy beheld the angelic warriors. The Quraysh trembled and fled. 70 of the bravest were slain, and 70 captives adorned the first victory of the faithful. The dead bodies of the Quraysh were despoiled and insulted. 2 of the most obnoxious prisoners were punished with death, and the ransom of the others, 4,000 drams of silver, compensated in some degree the escape of the caravan. But it was in vain that the camels of Abu Sufyan explored a new road through the desert and along the Euphrates. They were overtaken by the diligence of the Muslims, and wealthy must have been the prize if 20,000 drams could be set apart for the fifth of the apostle. The resentment of the public and private law stimulated Abu Sufyan to collect a body of 3,000 men, 700 of whom were armed with cuirasses, and 200 were mounted on horseback. 3,000 camels attended his march, and his wife, Henda, with 15 matrons of Mecca, incessantly sounded their timbrels to animate the troops and to magnify the greatness of Hubal, the most popular deity of the Kaaba. The standard of God and Muhammad was upheld by 950 believers. The disproportion of numbers was not more alarming than in the field of Badr, and their presumption of victory prevailed against the divine and human sense of the apostle. The second battle was fought on Mount Uhud, 6 miles to the north of Medina. The Quraysh advanced in the form of a crescent, and the right wing of cavalry was led by Khaled, the fiercest and most successful of the Arabian warriors. The troops of Muhammad were skillfully posted on the declivity of the hill, and their rear was guarded by a detachment of 50 archers. The weight of their charge impelled and broke the center of the idolaters, but in the pursuit they lost the advantage of their ground. The archers deserted their station. The Muslims were tempted by the spoil, disobeyed their general, and disordered their ranks. The intrepid Khalid, wheeling his cavalry on their flank and rear, exclaimed with a loud voice that Muhammad was slain. He was indeed wounded in the face with a javelin. Two of his teeth were shattered with a stone. Yet in the midst of tumult and dismay, he reproached the infidels with the murder of a prophet, and blessed the friendly hand that staunched his blood and conveyed him to a place of safety. 70 martyrs died for the sins of the people. They fell, said the apostle, in pairs, each brother embracing his lifeless companion. Their bodies were mangled by the inhuman females of Mecca, and the wife of Abu Sufyan tasted the entrails of Hamza, the uncle of Muhammad. They might applaud their superstition and satiate their fury, but the Muslims soon rallied in the field, and the Quraysh wanted strength or courage to undertake the siege of Medina. It was attacked the ensuing year by an army of 10,000 enemies, and this third expedition is variously named from the nations which marched under the banner of Abu Sufyan, from the ditch which was drawn before the city, and a camp of 3,000 Muslims. The prudence of Muhammad declined a general engagement. The valor of Ali was signalized in single combat, and the war was protracted 20 days, till the final separation of the Confederates. A tempest of wind, rain, and hail overturned their tents. Their private quarrels were fomented by an insidious adversary, and the Quraysh, deserted by their allies, no longer hoped to subvert the throne or to check the conquests of their invincible exile. The choice of Jerusalem for the first Qibla of prayer discovers the early propensity of Muhammad in favor of the Jews. And happy would it have been for their temporal interest had they recognized in the Arabian prophet the hope of Israel and the promised Messiah. Their obstinacy converted his friendship into implacable hatred, with which he pursued that unfortunate people to the last moment of his life. And in the double character of an apostle and a conqueror, his persecution was extended to both worlds. The Kainuka dwelt at Medina under the protection of the city. He seized the occasion of an accidental tumult and summoned them to embrace his religion or contend with him in battle. "Alas," replied the trembling Jews, "we are ignorant of the use of arms, but we persevere in the faith and worship of our fathers. Why wilt thou reduce us to the necessity of a just defense?" The unequal conflict was terminated in 15 days, and it was with extreme reluctance that Muhammad yielded to the importunity of his allies and consented to spare the lives of the captives. But their riches were confiscated, their arms became more effectual in the hands of the Muslims, and a wretched colony of 700 exiles was driven, with their wives and children, to implore a refuge on the confines of Syria. The Nadirites were more guilty, since they conspired in a friendly interview to assassinate the prophet. He besieged their castle 3 miles from Medina, but their resolute defense obtained an honorable capitulation, and the garrison, sounding their trumpets and beating their drums, was permitted to depart with the honors of war. The Jews had excited and joined the war of the Quraysh. No sooner had the nations retired from the ditch than Muhammad, without laying aside his armor, marched on the same day to extirpate the hostile race of the children of Quraida. After a resistance of 25 days, they surrendered at discretion. They trusted to the intercession of their old allies of Medina. They could not be ignorant that fanaticism obliterates the feelings of humanity. A venerable elder, to whose judgment they appealed, pronounced the sentence of their death. 700 Jews were dragged in chains to the marketplace of the city. They descended alive into the grave, prepared for their execution and burial. And the apostle beheld, with an inflexible eye, the slaughter of his helpless enemies. Their sheep and camels were inherited by the Muslims. 300 cuirasses, 500 piles, 1,000 lances composed the most useful portion of the spoil. 6 days' journey to the northeast of Medina, the ancient and wealthy town of Kaaba was the seat of the Jewish power in Arabia. The territory, a fertile spot on the desert, was covered with plantations and cattle, and protected by 8 castles, some of which were esteemed of impregnable strength. The forces of Muhammad consisted of 200 horse and 1,400 foot. In the succession of 8 regular and painful sieges, they were exposed to danger and fatigue and hunger, and the most undaunted chiefs despaired of the event. The apostle revived their faith and courage by the example of Ali, on whom he bestowed the surname of the Lion of God. Perhaps we may believe that a Hebrew champion of gigantic stature was cloven to the chest by his irresistible scimitar. But we cannot praise the modesty of romance, which represents him as tearing from its hinges the gate of a fortress and wielding the ponderous buckler in his left hand. After the reduction of the castles, the town of Kaaba submitted to the yoke. The chief of the tribe was tortured in the presence of Muhammad to force a confession of his hidden treasure. The industry of the shepherds and husbandmen was rewarded with a precarious toleration. They were permitted, so long as it should please the conqueror, to improve their patrimony in equal shares for his emolument and their own. Under the reign of Omar, the Jews of Kaaba were transported to Syria, and the caliph alleged the injunction of his dying master, that one and the true religion should be professed in his native land of Arabia. 5 times each day the eyes of Muhammad were turned towards Mecca, and he was urged by the most sacred and powerful motives to revisit as a conqueror the city and the temple from whence he had been driven as an exile. The Kaaba was present to his waking and sleeping fancy. An idle dream was translated into vision and prophecy. He unfurled the holy banner, and a rash promise of success too hastily dropped from the lips of the apostle. His march from Medina to Mecca displayed the peaceful and solemn pomp of a pilgrimage. 70 camels, chosen and bedecked for sacrifice, preceded the van. The sacred territory was respected, and the captives were dismissed without ransom to proclaim his clemency and devotion. But no sooner did Muhammad descend into the plain, within a day's journey of the city, than he exclaimed, "They have clothed themselves with the skins of tigers." The numbers and resolution of the Quraysh opposed his progress, and the roving Arabs of the desert might desert or betray a leader whom they had followed for the hopes of spoil. The intrepid fanatic sunk into a cool and cautious politician. He waived in the treaty his title of Apostle of God, concluded with the Quraysh and their allies a truce of 10 years, engaged to restore the fugitives of Mecca who should embrace his religion, and stipulated only for the ensuing year the humble privilege of entering the city as a friend and of remaining 3 days to accomplish the rites of the pilgrimage. A cloud of shame and sorrow hung on the retreat of the Muslims, and their disappointment might justly accuse the failure of a prophet who had so often appealed to the evidence of success. The faith and hope of the pilgrims were rekindled by the prospect of Mecca. Their swords were sheathed. 7 times in the footsteps of the apostle they encompassed the Kaaba. The Quraysh had retired to the hills, and Mohammed, after the customary sacrifice, evacuated the city on the 4th day. The people was edified by his devotion. The hostile chiefs were awed, or divided, or seduced. And both Khalid and Amru, the future conquerors of Syria and Egypt, most seasonably deserted the sinking cause of idolatry. The power of Muhammad was increased by the submission of the Arabian tribes. 10,000 soldiers were assembled for the conquest of Mecca, and the idolaters, the weaker party, were easily convicted of violating the truce. Enthusiasm and discipline impelled the march and preserved the secret till the blaze of 10,000 fires proclaimed to the astonished Quraysh the design, the approach, and the irresistible force of the enemy. The haughty Abu Sufyan presented the keys of the city, admired the variety of arms and incense that passed before him in review, observed that the son of Abdallah had acquired a mighty kingdom, and confessed under the scimitar of Omar that he was the apostle of the true God. The return of Marius and Scylla was stained with the blood of the Romans. The revenge of Mohammed was stimulated by religious zeal, and his injured followers were eager to execute or to prevent the order of a massacre. Instead of indulging their passions and his own, the victorious exile forgave the guilt and united the factions of Mecca. His troops, in 3 divisions, marched into the city. 28 of the inhabitants were slain by the sword of Khalid. 11 men and 6 women were proscribed by the sentence of Muhammad, but he blamed the cruelty of his lieutenant, and several of the most obnoxious victims were indebted for their lives to his clemency or contempt. The chiefs of the Quraysh were prostrate at his feet. "What mercy can you expect from the man whom you have wronged? We confide in the generosity of our kinsmen." "Then you shall not confide in vain. Begone. You are safe. You are free." The people of Mecca deserved their pardon by the profession of Islam, and after an exile of 7 years, the fugitive missionary was enthroned as the prince and prophet of his native country. But the 360 idols of the Kaaba were ignominiously broken. The house of God was purified and adorned. As an example to future times, the apostle again fulfilled the duties of a pilgrim, and a perpetual law was enacted that no unbeliever should dare to set his foot on the territory of the holy city. The conquest of Mecca determined the faith and obedience of the Arabian tribes, who, according to the vicissitudes of fortune, had obeyed or disregarded the eloquence or the arms of the prophet. Indifference for rights and opinions still marks the character of the Bedouins, and they might accept as loosely as they hold the doctrine of the Quran. Yet an obstinate remnant still adhered to the religion and liberty of their ancestors, and the War of Hunain derived a proper appellation from the idols, whom Muhammad had vowed to destroy, and whom the confederates of Taif had sworn to defend. 4,000 pagans advanced with secrecy and speed to surprise the conqueror. They pitied and despised the supine negligence of the Quraysh, but they depended on the wishes and perhaps the aid of a people who had so lately renounced their gods and bowed beneath the yoke of their enemy. The banners of Medina and Mecca were displayed by the prophet. A crowd of Bedouins increased the strength or numbers of the army, and 12,000 Muslims entertained a rash and sinful presumption of their invincible strength. They descended without precaution into the valley of Hunain. The heights had been occupied by the archers and slingers of the Confederates. Their numbers were oppressed, their discipline was confounded, their courage was appalled, and the Quraysh smiled at their impending destruction. The prophet, on his white mule, was encompassed by the enemies. He attempted to rush against their spears in search of a glorious death. 10 of his faithful companions interposed their weapons and their breasts. 3 of these fell dead at his feet. "O my brethren," he repeatedly cried with sorrow and indignation, "I am the son of Abdallah. I am the apostle of truth. O man, stand fast in the faith. O God, send down thy succor." His uncle, Abbas, who, like the heroes of Homer, excelled in the loudness of his voice, made the valley resound with the recital of the gifts and promises of God. The flying Muslims returned from all sides to the holy standard, and Mohammed observed with pleasure that the furnace was again rekindled. His conduct and example restored the battle, and he animated his victorious troops to inflict a merciless revenge on the authors of their shame. From the field of Hunain he marched without delay to the siege of Taif, 60 miles to the southeast of Mecca, a fortress of strength whose fertile lands produced the fruits of Syria in the midst of the Arabian desert. A friendly tribe, instructed, I know not how, in the art of sieges, supplied him with a train of battering rams and military engines, with a body of 500 artificers. But it was in vain that he offered freedom to the slaves of Taif, that he violated his own laws by the extirpation of the fruit trees, that the ground was opened by the miners, that the breach was assaulted by the troops. After a siege of 20 days, the prophet sounded a retreat, but he retreated with a song of devout triumph, and affected to pray for the repentance and safety of the unbelieving city. The spoils of this fortunate expedition amounted to 6,000 captives, 24,000 camels, 40,000 sheep, and 4,000 ounces of silver. A tribe who had fought at Hunain redeemed their prisoners by the sacrifice of their idols. But Mohammed compensated the loss by resigning to the soldiers his 1/5 of the plunder, and wished, for their sake, that he possessed as many head of cattle as there were trees in the province of Tahama. Instead of chastising the disaffection of the Quraysh, he endeavored to cut out their tongues, his own expression, and to secure their attachment by a superior measure of liberality. Abu Sufyan alone was presented with 300 camels and 20 ounces of silver, and Mecca was sincerely converted to the profitable religion of the Quran. The fugitives and auxiliaries complained that they who had borne the burden were neglected in the season of victory. "Alas," replied their artful leader, "suffer me to conciliate these recent enemies, these doubtful proselytes, by the gift of some perishable goods. To your guard I entrust my life and fortunes. You are the companions of my exile, of my kingdom, of my paradise." He was followed by the deputies of Taif, who dreaded the repetition of a siege. "Grant us, O apostle of God, a truce of 3 years, with the toleration of our ancient worship. Not a month, not an hour. Excuse us at least from the obligations of prayer. Without prayer, religion is of no avail." They submitted in silence. Their temples were demolished, and the same sentence of destruction was executed on all the idols of Arabia. His lieutenants on the shores of the Red Sea, the ocean, and the Gulf of Persia were saluted by the acclamations of a faithful people, and the ambassadors who knelt before the throne of Medina were as numerous, says the Arabian proverb, as the dates that fall from the maturity of a palm tree. The nation submitted to the god and the scepter of Muhammad. The opprobrious name of tribute was abolished. The spontaneous or reluctant oblations of alms and tithes were applied to the service of religion, and 114,000 Muslims accompanied the last pilgrimage of the apostle. When Heraclius returned in triumph from the Persian War, he entertained at Emesa one of the ambassadors of Muhammad, who invited the princes and nations of the earth to the profession of Islam. On this foundation, the zeal of the Arabians has supposed the secret conversion of the Christian emperor. The vanity of the Greeks has feigned a personal visit of the prince of Medina, who accepted from the royal bounty a rich domain and a secure retreat in the province of Syria. But the friendship of Heraclius and Muhammad was of short continuance. The new religion had inflamed, rather than assuaged, the rapacious spirit of the Saracens, and the murder of an envoy afforded a decent pretense for invading, with 3,000 soldiers, the territory of Palestine that extends to the eastward of the Jordan. The holy banner was entrusted to Zayd, and such was the discipline or enthusiasm of the rising sect that the noblest chiefs served without reluctance under the slave of the prophet. On the event of his decease, Ja'afar and Abdallah were successively substituted to the command. And if the three should perish in the war, the troops were authorized to elect their general. The three leaders were slain in the Battle of Muta, the first military action which tried the valor of the Muslims against a foreign enemy. Zayd fell, like a soldier, in the foremost ranks. The death of Ja'afar was heroic and memorable. He lost his right hand. He shifted the standard to his left. The left was severed from his body. He embraced the standard with his bleeding stumps, till he was transfixed to the ground with 50 honorable wounds. "Advance!" cried Abdallah, who stepped into the vacant place. "Advance with confidence. Either victory or paradise is our own." The lance of a Roman decided the alternative. But the falling standard was rescued by Khaled, the proselyte of Mecca. 9 swords were broken in his hand, and his valor withstood and repulsed the superior numbers of the Christians. In the nocturnal council of the camp he was chosen to command. His skillful evolutions of the ensuing day secured either the victory or the retreat of the Saracens. And Khaled is renowned among his brethren and his enemies by the glorious appellation of the Sword of God. In the pulpit, Muhammad described with prophetic rapture the crowns of the blessed martyrs, but in private he betrayed the feelings of human nature. He was surprised as he wept over the daughter of Zayd. "What do I see?" said the astonished votary. "You see," replied the apostle, "a friend who is deploring the loss of his most faithful friend." After the conquest of Mecca, the sovereign of Arabia affected to prevent the hostile preparations of Heraclius, and solemnly proclaimed war against the Romans without attempting to disguise the hardships and dangers of the enterprise. The Muslims were discouraged. They alleged the want of money or horses or provisions, the season of harvest and the intolerable heat of the summer. "Hell is much hotter," said the indignant prophet. He disdained to compel their service, but on his return he admonished the most guilty by an excommunication of 50 days. Their desertion enhanced the merit of Abu Bakr, Uthman, and the faithful companions who devoted their lives and fortunes, and Muhammad displayed his banner at the head of 10,000 horse and 20,000 foot. Painful indeed was the distress of the march. Lassitude and thirst were aggravated by the scorching and pestilential winds of the desert. 10 men rode by turns on 1 camel, and they were reduced to the shameful necessity of drinking the water from the belly of that useful animal. In the midway, 10 days' journey from Medina and Damascus, they reposed near the grove and fountain of Tabuk. Beyond that place, Mohammed declined the prosecution of the war. He declared himself satisfied with the peaceful intentions. He was more probably daunted by the martial array of the Emperor of the East. But the active and intrepid Khalid spread around the terror of his name, and the prophet received the submission of the tribes and cities from the Euphrates to Ailach, at the head of the Red Sea. To his Christian subjects, Mohammed readily granted the security of their persons, the freedom of their trade, the property of their goods, and the toleration of their worship. The weakness of their Arabian brethren had restrained them from opposing his ambition. The disciples of Jesus were endeared to the enemy of the Jews, and it was the interest of a conqueror to propose a fair capitulation to the most powerful religion of the earth. Till the age of 63 years, the strength of Mohammed was equal to the temporal and spiritual fatigues of his mission. His epileptic fits, an absurd calumny of the Greeks, would be an object of pity rather than abhorrence. But he seriously believed that he was poisoned at Khaibar by the revenge of a Jewish female. During 4 years, the health of the prophet declined. His infirmities increased, but his mortal disease was a fever of 14 days, which deprived him by intervals of the use of reason. As soon as he was conscious of his danger, he edified his brethren by the humility of his virtue or penitence. "If there be any man," said the apostle from the pulpit, "whom I have unjustly scourged, I submit my own back to the lash of retaliation. Have I aspersed the reputation of a Muslim? Let him proclaim my thoughts in the face of the congregation. Has anyone been despoiled of his goods? The little that I possess shall compensate the principal and the interest of the debt." "Yes," replied a voice from the crowd. "I am entitled to 3 drams of silver." Mohammed heard the complaint, satisfied the demand, and thanked his creditor for accusing him in this world rather than at the day of judgment. He beheld with temperate firmness the approach of death, enfranchised his slaves, 17 men, as they are named, and 11 women, minutely directed the order of his funeral, and moderated the lamentations of his weeping friends, on whom he bestowed the benediction of peace. Till the 3rd day before his death, he regularly performed the function of public prayer. The choice of Abu Bakr to supply his place appeared to mark that ancient and faithful friend as his successor in the sacerdotal and regal office. But he prudently declined the risk and envy of a more explicit nomination. At a moment when his faculties were visibly impaired, he called for pen and ink to write, or more properly, to dictate a divine book, the sum and accomplishment of all his revelations. A dispute arose in the chamber whether he should be allowed to supersede the authority of the Quran, and the prophet was forced to reprove the indecent vehemence of his disciples. "If the slightest credit may be afforded to the traditions of his wives and companions, he maintained in the bosom of his family, and to the last moments of his life, the dignity of an apostle and the faith of an enthusiast. Described the visits of Gabriel, who bade an everlasting farewell to the earth, and expressed his lively confidence not only of the mercy but of the favor of the Supreme Being. In a familiar discourse he had mentioned his special prerogative that the angel of death was not allowed to take his soul till he had respectfully asked the permission of the prophet. The request was granted, and Mohammed immediately fell into the agony of his dissolution. His head was reclined on the lap of Ayesha, the best beloved of all his wives. He fainted with the violence of pain. Recovering his spirits, he raised his eyes towards the roof of the house, and with a steady look, though a faltering voice, uttered the last broken, though articulate words, "O God, pardon my sins. Yes, I come among my fellow citizens on high." And thus peaceably expired on a carpet spread upon the floor. An expedition for the conquest of Syria was stopped by this mournful event. The army halted at the gates of Medina. The chiefs were assembled round their dying master. The city, more especially the house of the prophet, was a scene of clamorous sorrow, of silent despair. Fanaticism alone could suggest a ray of hope and consolation. "How can he be dead, our witness, our intercessor, our mediator, with God? By God, he is not dead. Like Moses and Jesus, he is wrapped in a holy trance, and speedily will he return to his faithful people." The evidence of sense was disregarded, and Omar, unsheathing his scimitar, threatened to strike off the heads of the infidels who should dare to affirm that the prophet was no more. The tumult was appeased by the weight and moderation of Abu Bakr. "Is it Muhammad," said he to Omar and the multitude, "or the God of Muhammad whom you worship?" "The God of Muhammad liveth forever. But the apostle was a mortal like ourselves, and according to his own prediction, he has experienced the common fate of mortality. He was piously interred by the hands of his nearest kinsman on the same spot on which he expired. Medina has been sanctified by the death and burial of Muhammad, and the innumerable pilgrims of Mecca often turn aside from the way to bow in voluntary devotion before the simple tomb of the prophet." At the conclusion of the life of Muhammad, it may perhaps be expected that I should balance his faults and virtues, that I should decide whether the title of enthusiast or impostor more properly belongs to that extraordinary man. Had I been intimately conversant with the son of Abdallah, the task would still be difficult, and the success uncertain. At the distance of 12 centuries, I darkly contemplate his shade through a cloud of religious incense, and could I truly delineate the portrait of an hour, the fleeting resemblance would not equally apply to the solitary of Mount Hira, to the preacher of Mecca, and to the conqueror of Arabia. The author of a mighty revolution appears to have been endowed with a pious and contemplative disposition. So soon as marriage had raised him above the pressure of want, he avoided the paths of ambition and avarice, and till the age of 40 he lived with innocence and would have died without a name. The unity of God is an idea most congenial to nature and reason, and a slight conversation with the Jews and Christians would teach him to despise and detest the idolatry of Mecca. It was the duty of a man and a citizen to impart the doctrine of salvation, to rescue his country from the dominion of sin and error. The energy of a mind incessantly bent on the same object would convert a general obligation into a particular call. The warm suggestions of the understanding or the fancy would be felt as the inspirations of heaven. The labor of thought would